You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. So, tonight Aloud, with our soon-to-be neighbor on Grand Avenue, the Broad Museum, debuts the Unprivate Collections series. And this series, as it moves forward, will pair art world scholars with artists who are represented in depth in the Broad Collections, exploring in particular the relationship between the personal and the political in the artist's work and life. I want to mention two upcoming programs in that series, besides tonight's program, which will take place this fall. On November 23rd at 1 p.m. at the Raymond C. Cortinas School of Visual and Performing Arts up the street, Los Angeles artist Mark Bradford will sit down with Katie Siegel, author, professor, and chief curator of the Hunter College Galleries, to discuss the work of Robert Rauschenberg. And Mark himself makes use of the discarded materials of urban life in his ongoing engagement with his South Central Los Angeles community, and he's been very influenced by Robert Rauschenberg. And on December 12th at 7 p.m. here at the library, Aloud and the Broad will present artist Shireen Nishat in conversation with Christy McClear, the executive director of the Robert Rauschenberg Foundation. And Shireen is a photo and video artist who has addressed issues of social repression in her native Iran, among many other issues, and we're very, very excited about her coming here. Now, on to tonight's program, which features the founders of the Broad Museum, Eli and Edie Broad, plus Joanne Heiler, director of the Broad Museum, and it's moderated by Inga Rees, director of the Frix Collection, a center for the history of collecting. After their conversation, we will open to questions from you, and we will be circulating microphones so we can all hear and be as we record for podcasts. So just hang on until the microphone comes to you. Eli and Edie Broad are known worldwide for their philanthropy in the fields of education, science, and the arts. The Broads have built two prominent collections of post-war and contemporary art worldwide, the Eli and Edith Broad Collection and the Broad Art Collection Foundation. The two collections together include nearly 2,000 works by more than 200 artists. And since 1984, the Broad Art Foundation has operated an active lending library. It's a wonderful concept for a museum of its extensive collection. Joanne Heiler, who will be seated over there, is the director, chief curator of the Broad Art Foundation. She has curated the Broad collections and directed the foundation's lending library program since 1995. And as advisor to the Broads, she is closely involved with their philanthropic investments in the visual arts, and she is the director of the New Contemporary Art Museum on Grand Avenue and is leading the team charged with planning the institution and building the Diller Scofidio and Renfro designed museum. Inga Rees is the director of the Frick Collections Center for the History of Collecting and the chief of research collections and programs at the Frick Art Reference Library. How many of you have been to the Frick? It's such a small but stunning museum off Fifth Avenue in New York, and it houses the collection of steel magnate Henry Clay Frick, and it's just a great treat to spend an afternoon in contemplation of a Vermeer or a Rembrandt in those beautiful rooms. It's rare. We don't often get to hear from the art collectors about their motivations and inspirations for collecting art. And as Inga Rees herself has pointed out, the history of art collecting and patronage is in many ways the history of art itself. And Inga will tell you a little bit more about the Center for Collecting tonight as she kicks off our conversation. Now please welcome our distinguished guests, Eli and Edie Broad, and Joanne Heiler and Inga Rees. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much, Louise and Ken, for this warm welcome. I can't tell you how happy I am to be here tonight and to have this opportunity to talk to Eli and Edie Broad about their art collection and the extraordinary foundation and private collection museum that they are poised to give to the public of Los Angeles with the inauguration of the Broad Museum coming to us very soon. I had a hard hat tour the other day, and I'm really excited myself, and will come beetling back from New York as soon as I know that the doors have opened. It's going to be an extraordinary, extraordinary building and treat to see the collection. I'm here to give a little context to you, because we all know that history repeats itself in some manner or another. And of course, I'm a very captive member of the audience when it comes to talking about private collection museums, because I've been at the Frick for many years. And it's just this kind of gesture to the public that Henry Clay Frick made almost 100 years ago in founding the Frick Collection. And not surprisingly, then, that leads those of us who work there to strive to gain a better understanding of what makes private collectors do what they do. And this governs so much of the programming at our museum, our library, and now, of course, at the Center for the History of Collecting that we inaugurated 7 years ago. It's surprising to me that 7 years ago, it was very clear that people were becoming more and more interested in art collecting, and yet the study of art collecting was still a comparatively neglected area of inquiry within the larger field of art history. And I think this is really incredibly unfair, to put it bluntly, because it is the art collectors who bring together the works of art, who care for the works of art over time, who make it possible for we art historians to actually study the art and try to get an understanding of how art reflects its own time. So we owe a tremendous debt to the collectors, and yet academics have managed to give them short shrift, I think, for many years, and we're trying to redress that balance with the center. So we have symposia, we have fellowships, we mostly focus on the history of collecting, as the name implies, and as the resources of the Frick Art Reference Library would call for, because we do have such rich collections of auction catalogs going back to the 18th century, and photographs that have never, of works of art in private hands that have never been otherwise published. So all manner of research is done in these halls, but we do at the center feel that we should embrace a commitment to present-day collectors as well and build these relationships through our oral history programs and through contact with collectors and with our support groups and the like. And that way we can enrich this already richly interdisciplinary field of the history of collecting that enables us to use a key that opens the door to a better understanding of cultural history, of of an era when collectors were moved by political, socioeconomic forces to do what they did. I have to say, I got all the way through a PhD program at an Ivy League university, and nobody asked me to look at an auction catalog. Nobody ever suggested that I try to examine market forces or what made collectors do what they did. And it wasn't until I was in the trenches in a library that I started to realize how much I could learn from all of this and how I could almost feel the pulse of collectors from the past. So not to miss any opportunities, it was actually through our oral history program that I first met Eli and Edie. They were among our first victims, if you will, and they kindly agreed to sit for rather long interviews, but did so willingly because I think they too understood that what a journalist might say, that these oral histories are the first draft of the history of collecting of our present day. So as much as I enjoy reading what they had to say, more important still is the fact that in generations hence, scholars will be able to read and listen to the words of the collectors themselves, recounting the stories, the anecdotes, their motivations, how their collecting has changed through time. But actually, history does repeat itself, and our oral histories bring that to light in some ways as well, because I think you could say nowhere is that more obvious than in the public-private partnerships and philanthropy in the arts in this country, most especially in this country. I know you could make a case, I suppose, for saying that the great museums of Europe, the Prado, the Louvre, and the Kunsthistorisches Museum in Vienna and the like are all the products of private collections too, royal collections. But that seems a bit of a reach to me when I look for parallels. And I think the more apt model for American philanthropic collectors establishing personal museum, personal collection museums are the Brits in the early 19th century, the illegitimate son of the of Lord Hertford, founded the Wallace Collection, Richard Wallace. The Duke of Wellington founded Apsley House. This was his collection. The great architect, John Soane, established the Soane Museum. These became the models for what would come into full flower in the United States during our Gilded Age, with the Gardner, the Frick, the Morgan, the Walters, the Huntington out here on the West Coast. And then that model was embellished and perpetuated by people like the Flaglers in Florida, and John Ringling, for that matter, also in Florida. And all of these private collection museums have a lot in common, but I think the most important thing that they share is that by keeping their collections intact, their founders have given us the opportunity to capture a snapshot in time, the portrait of a particular collection, and in a way of those collectors who amassed these works. And as I look at our research fellows at the center struggling to reconstitute what was in a collection that was later dispersed, I feel that we have to be incredibly grateful for those collectors who went to the trouble of building a museum and keeping their collection intact to freeze that moment in time for future generations. So with that, I think it's time that we heard from the collectors themselves, and I've put together a few questions that I will enjoy posing to them, and then it'll be open to you. Eli and Edie, I know that private collectors in America have lent to exhibitions forever, really. One of the blockbusters of the early 20th century was the Hudson Fulton exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum in 1909, and any collector who was anybody was eager to lend to this. Morgan, Frick, Havemeyer, Altman, you name it. Frick had a huge loan show of his collection at the Boston Museum in 1910, but nobody would argue that Frick's primary mission was to be a lender. I mean, not happening. Whereas the Broad Foundation was established as a lending library, apropos libraries, and I was just wondering if there were any models in your minds as you created this mission for your foundation, and now that will carry forward, as I understand it, to the museum as well.
I think what we're doing is really a new paradigm. We've given a lot of thought, what we can do with our collection. And as it grew and grew to almost 2,000 works now between our personal foundation collection, we concluded that to show it to the broadest possible audience, we should continue the activities of the Broad Art Foundation, which has made 8,000 loans to 500 different institutions. And at the same time, instead of having a small building in Santa Monica with art and storage at six different places, we thought it was time to build a building, and we chose downtown Los Angeles next to Walt Disney Concert Hall. And that building will be able to house about, we'll be able to show 250 or 300 works, and the rest, about 90% of work, we'll be able to store there in open storage. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And our mission is very simple. We want our art shown to the broadest possible audience, whether it's in our building or various museums in this state and throughout the world.
Uh-huh. That's fabulous. As I understand it, even the works that are in storage will peek out from time to time. Is that
they
right,
will.
Joanne?
Yeah, visitors will have a chance to see into the back of house, so to speak, in this museum, which in a way that's different from any other museum I know of that's attempted any kind of display of storage before. So, yes, there'll be a very interesting glimpse as you pass through certain parts of the building into what we call the vault that I'll describe later.
That's wonderful. Joanne, there have been advisors to great art collectors since time immemorial, really. Probably the most famous instance of that is Bernard Berenson and Isabella Stewart Gardner. But nobody would think that Mrs. Jack didn't have a mind of her own, too. So I was wondering if you, and perhaps Edie and Eli as well, could tell us a little bit about the decision-making process, how you work together.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, you know, one of the great pleasures of the position that I'm in with the foundation is that for decades now, we've collected the way a private collector collects, very simply, without the burden of committees and approval processes and fundraising in the normal museum sense of the word that most museums have. But the Broads, from the very beginning, recognized that it was important to take the works that were collected that way and put them aside for public institutional use. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, the collection since the mid-80s has been a public collection, the foundation collection specifically. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we're able to, you know, have the ambitions and the goal of public exposure for the collection to the greatest extent possible, while we can move very nimbly and quickly in the market. And that was very much a response and a fortunate response to the climate of the 80s, which is when the foundation was established. Mm-hmm. That's when the art market was going through a major boom. Yeah. There was a blip, and now we're in a boom again, of course. But there was a lot of speculative buying. There was a lot of artwork going into hiding while people waited for the value of it to rise, and there was no interest in having the public see it. So the Broads really felt that it was important to create a public repository that many institutions could pull from and share. So that's where the lending library metaphor comes from. And yet we could move very nimbly in the market. Mm-hmm. So that's what we've attempted to do over these many years. Mm-hmm. Now, the sort of decision-making process, why do we add an artist? Why do we add a specific artwork? That's a little subtler and more elusive thing to try to pin down. But, you know, but we, at this stage, especially with the collection, we look and we watch an artist's work for quite some time before we commit, because we also are very dedicated to collecting in depth. And so with some artists, we have over 100 examples of their works. So when we buy an artist's work, it's a commitment. Mm. It's not a one-night stand.
Right, right.
It's a commitment. It's a very you know, serious move for the foundation and the Broads to make. Yeah, so we watch carefully for a number of years before we buy.
Edie, I wonder if there were some, maybe even before Joanne came to you, though that was quite a while ago, have there been some dealers who you became particularly close to and got to know in a trusting and trusted sort of way?
I think our favorite, at least my favorite dealer, was probably Leo Castelli, because he was kind of he was a gentleman and he was old school. He took very good care of his artists, whether they sold or not. He kept giving them shows. He believed in them. He sometimes gave them stipends so they could keep going. So he was very special, and he was really the first dealer we spent any time with, and it was a treat. Larry Gagosian is a very active dealer that we have a relationship with. He is different from Leo in that he's... he's a more aggressive dealer.
Really?
But he's very good, and he takes good care of his artists. And I'm trying to think, who else? Paula Cooper is someone, and the Metro Pictures Gallery are people we've had long relationships with and enjoy.
Early on, and Mary Boone.
Mary Boone. And one more. His children are in the gallery now. And he deals in the secondary
Pace?
Market. No.
Are you talking?
Aquavella.
Bill Aquavella. Pace, we've known him for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And he also is just a lovely, lovely man. And it's been a joy to really know all of them.
I have to say, we're enjoying all of this, too, at the Center for the History of Collecting, because since we now are in this contemporary world, we have an opportunity to meet people like that, and it is fascinating. 100 years, I've been sort of wrestling with this contrast myself. 100 years ago, the great collectors of America's Gilded Age tended to start off collecting contemporary art. They went to the salons, and they went to artist studios, and they were fascinated by the contemporary scene, and they were not particularly interested in the old masters. And then as they grew older, they morphed into becoming collectors of old master pictures. This holds true of Frick and Morgan and almost all of them, really, Walters. You're the opposite.
That's true.
and started out with older art, and I just would be delighted if you could trace that process.
We started with an early important purchase was a Van Gogh drawing from 1889, then a Picasso and Matisse, and Miro, and some others. But as time went on, we became interested in moving forward and meeting artists of our time, which is contemporary art, because we felt we could learn a great deal from them, how they viewed society, how they view the world. And it was a lot of fun being with the artists, going to their studios, seeing their work, and reading all the reviews of their work. So that we kept moving in time.
And you also had better choices. So many of the earlier works were in museums or private collections, whereas with the artists of our time, there was just, you know, it was kind of maybe a little more interesting.
If you go back in history, most collections were built within a few years after the work was actually done, rather than trying to go back 50 or 100 years.
That's true. Especially, well, and that brings up patronage, of course, too, and the support of artists. One, I've read here and there your comments that you alluded to a minute ago, that artists have a special viewpoint, whether that's about a political issue or a social issue, and that they take risks in a way. But you're a risk taker. And have coined the phrase of venture philanthropy and the like. And I wonder if you feel that by supporting present-day artists, you are sharing in their risk.
In a way, we are. Although some of the artists we started collecting 30 years ago don't need anyone to share the risk any longer. But I go back, I remember the early days where we met Jean-Michel Basquiat, working in the basement of Anina Desai, and bought his work before anyone else did. The same thing with Keith Haring. And I remember we met with Jeff Koons when he had a studio on Houston and in Broadway. And then I still remember the morning we went down to Metro Pictures on Mercer Street, went in the basement, and we're not photography collectors, but we saw the first work of Cindy Sherman. We've been acquiring her work ever since, and that's been quite a ride, and we have about 130 works over the
More
last
than
30
anyone,
years.
I think. Is that right? Yeah.
And it's a lot of fun.
Do you think there is a lot of work in your collection and in the foundation collection that relates to social and political commentary? It's pretty clear, and I do you relate that to some of your interests in education as well, or is that a separate matter? Do you think there's education?
I think it may relate to my upbringing, where my parents were very interested in society and the well-being of the lower class and the middle classes and so on. Mm-hmm. So it's of interest to see artists that do make a statement about how they see the world, whether it's people like Leon Golub or a number of others.
Well, thinking about how you have this personal contact with the artists, and you, in many cases, have seen them grow, so they might not have been very intimidating when you first met them or anything like that. And I don't get the impression that you're easily awestruck, but I wonder if you have ever been awestruck by something, either a work of art or the setup of an artist's studio or his or her manner of work.
Well, from the first day we met Jeff Koons and went to his studio on Houston Broadway to today, we're sort of awestruck by his creativity and how he moves forward and the number of people he has working in his studio.
And Kiefer. Anselm Kiefer has a studio, 300,000 square feet, and he gets around on a bicycle.
We were just there last June, actually.
Yeah. Visited him outside of Paris.
That's amazing.
It's amazing.
Did he greet you on the bicycle?
Oh, yes.
He did. You have to love it.
It was a long ride from the one end of the studio to the other, actually, believe it or
Fantastic.
Not. Fantastic. That's an image of Koon's studio, by the way, just on the screen now.
I was thinking that you are also a patron of architects, and yet there's no one size fits all for the architectural ventures that you have supported. There's extraordinary variety of taste and function in the buildings that have been built.
Well, after all, architecture is a mother of all the arts. And amongst the early architects we worked with were Charlie Guatney, where we did some things at Pitzer College, where I chaired the board, built several buildings. Then we worked with Rate Izasaki when I was the founding chairman of MoCA. And then along the way worked with Richard Meyer, who did our beach house, Frank Gehry, of course, in Walt Disney Concert Hall and the design of our home. More recently, Zaha Hadid, who did a museum for us, where I went to school at Michigan State University, Wolf Prie at the Arts High School down the street. So we love architects, and we love architecture.
And Tom Main.
Tom Main also, when he did the Caltrans building, we were involved in that also.
Can you tell us a little bit about what went into your thinking for the Broad Museum's building, the latest, soon to be
okay.
the latest?
Okay, well, one, we had a competition, and we said, look, we want a great piece of architecture, but it can't clash with Walt Disney Concert Hall, but we don't want it to be anonymous either. So we had six world-class architects make presentations. We had a jury that included several museum directors and others. And we ended up picking Liz Diller. We're very impressed with what she did. We're impressed with what she did at Lincoln Center. We're impressed with what they did in the High Line, New York, a number of other works. So that's how we made that selection.
It seems brilliant to me. Joanne, do you have a few words you'd like to say about the building? You've been living with this, at least.
We've been living with it for under construction for a while. The competition was back in 2010, so we've been working hard with DSR for quite a few years now. And they've been amazing to work with. I mean, one of the things that struck me about the proposal that Diller Scofidio Renfro made in the very beginning was that they distinguished their proposal from other museum buildings by really taking very seriously what we were talking about in the beginning, which is the lending component of our institution, our mission. So they architecturally, kind of symbolically, dealt with that and made it into a very striking and dramatic architectural gesture by placing what they call the vault in the center of the building. It's on the middle floor. It's not, you know, storage in most museums is tucked away. It's unseen. It's in the basements. It's in the back. And in this building, by contrast, it's right in the center. And actually, to get to the main galleries, you're going to take an escalator or an elevator that essentially goes right through that vault and then deposits you up on the third floor where you have a vast skylit space. So I was really struck by exactly what Eli said, how she talked about how Disney Hall was, because it's a performance space, it's about reflecting light away and away from the performance space. So you have this intimate place for sound, and that's sort of otherworldly. An art museum, by contrast, needs to bring light in a very, very careful way to illuminate the collection. And so our building is very much about sort of solids and transparency and the interplay of the two. So there'll be light coming in from the skylights, of course, but also some side lighting, as you can see in the image, in the galleries, which will make the top floor galleries really sing. Mm-hmm. They also figured out a way to make the top floor almost an acre of column-free gallery space.
Wow.
So, so you emerge through the vault, and I think there might be an image of this. So here's a section, a slice through the building. So the vault is the massive, darker portion in the center, and the galleries are up top. So you'll emerge after this journey from a very dynamic lobby through the vault into this beautiful third floor space with natural light everywhere. So I loved how she dealt with our institutional mission through the building, which I thought was really brilliant, honestly, and unlike what anyone else did. And it's unlike any museum I've visited as well.
I can't wait. I'm sure you all feel the same
way. It's an image of the lobby here.
Eli, I want to talk a little bit about your philanthropy, as you very aptly call it, venture philanthropy. Here again, I could make a case that this sort of risk-taking philanthropy has precedent in American private and public partnerships in the arts. Metropolitan Museum was founded by a bunch of artists and civic-minded people with no art collection at all. A lot of people don't realize that.
That's how MoCA was founded, also, without an art collection.
So if you want to found a museum, go right ahead, because apparently you don't need an art collection. But but that is a very special American characteristic. I personally don't know of any European precedent along those lines.
And there's hardly any American precedent.
That's true also. Too. But that love, that willingness to take a chance, does seem to be very particular to American patronage of the arts in the performing arts as well. And I wondered if you have any thoughts about why that is.
Well, I think the people you've mentioned at Sarah Museums have all been entrepreneurs early in their life and are really by nature risk takers, but they also measure, as I do, the risk versus the rewards. Mm-hmm. And also, I think we all want to leave something behind for future generations.
I think that's certainly
true. I also think that people that do things like that probably immigrated from other countries to start with, someone in the family.
That's interesting.
And that they weren't satisfied to just stay where they were, so they were willing to take the risk to come to a new place where they really didn't know what they were getting. I just think it's an American spirit.
Yeah. Well, there certainly is that mobility.
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Well, and then there's also the balance that you face of serving on many boards, not just the boards of your own institutions. And I wonder, I mean, there are other people who do that, Mimi Haas and Ronald Lauder. You have plenty of company.
Good friends, yes.
Yeah, you have plenty of company in that regard. But I wonder if you could address just a little bit, tell us about how you manage that balancing act of support.
Well, let me give you some history. I was a founding chairman, as I mentioned, of MoCA in 1979, and I stayed on until 1993. And I felt very good about being able to create an institution with others that didn't exist, that acquired some great collections and is world-renowned now. Then I got involved at LACMA when they had difficulties, and a woman became the director,
Andrea Rich,
who I knew from UCLA, and I served there for a number of years. MoMA, we spent a lot of time in New York, and MoMA is the most important modern contemporary museum in probably the world. So being part of that is a great learning experience with some great fellow trustees, a great curatorial staff, a great director and alike.
Makes absolute sense. What advice would you give to young collectors just starting out?
The first thing I tell, art is not an investment. You've got to invest more time if you really want to be a collector. It's not about just money. It's about learning. It's about meeting young artists. It's about seeing what they're doing, whether it's in MFA shows at universities, or maybe even starting out buying prints and so on. But it's also about getting all the art publications and spending a lot of time at it in museums and art galleries. That would be my advice.
I would say look. Spend a lot of time looking. Go to museums, go to galleries, and look. And ask questions.
Right. And don't be in a hurry to acquire anything.
Yeah. Well, I think that it separates the wheat from the chaff among collectors when they really look and they really have done their homework. And I personally get the feeling that it's fun for you, that you have had a good time.
It is fun. In my commercial business life, we travel the world, so whatever city we were in, we'd visit museums and sometimes dealers and artist studios. Uh-huh. And we still do that.
Nice.
It is fun. And it's broadening. And I like to say I'd be bored to death if I spent all my time with other business people, lawyers, and accountants, and bankers.
Dear me. Well, before I open the questioning up to the audience, I'd kind of like to bring our conversation full circle by asking you what role you could envision an entity like our Center for the History of Collecting can play vis-a-vis present-day collectors beyond oral histories and the like, because in our own way, it's not venture philanthropy, believe me, but it's not venture capitalism either, but we are on an adventure doing
well,
this.
Well, I
we
think
need to hear from people. Like
I think
you.
If you publish what you're doing in the way of case studies, mm-hmm. showing collectors presently or in the future mm-hmm. How people built their collections, what they did with their collections, mm-hmm. it would be very worthwhile.
Uh-huh. Very interesting.
I love going to the J.P. Morgan Library, uh-huh. and I would love to know more about the collectors that came before us.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And I think that what
through
you're doing is
studies.
Important. It's nice to have that history. It's just, all history is important. Mm-hmm. And this is one that's been a little neglected, I think.
Mm-hmm, I think so, too.
So.
That's good. That's good. Mm-hmm. Good advice. Thank you. Well, though I have other questions I could ask, I know there are a lot of eager people out here who want to ask you questions themselves. So we should probably get started with that.
I'm seeing eager people.
Oh, wow, goody. I'm so excited to be the first one. Thank you so much, Eli and Edie, for this amazing gift that you're giving to the city of Los Angeles and to the art world. I grew up in Chicago, and when I was a very little boy, my mom took me to the Art Institute, and I wandered the halls and discovered Hopper and Chagall and O'Keefe mm-hmm. and just amazing artists, and developed a passion and love for art. And so I'm curious, similarly, what was your early exposure and kind of what influenced and shaped you and your tastes and kind of your early experiences similar to mine? I'd be curious to know.
Edie was the first collector in our family, so once she started.
I was very fortunate. My parents did not go to museums. My dad had a small business and he worked all the time. But I went to a really good public school, and once a month they took us on a cultural experience, mostly the art museum, the Detroit Institute of Arts, but also to the symphony and other musical things. And I don't know why, but just from the very beginning, my favorite thing was always going to the museum. We had a lot of magazines and books at home, and I was always drawn to the issues that had articles about art. So I would just say it was just something that interested me and I liked looking at from a very early age. And I started out buying works on paper and prints, not expensive. And it was just something I enjoyed doing. I was very excited when Eli became interested because the acquisition budget went up.
Can you tell the Campbell Soup Warhol story? I know the Campbell Soup Warhol story.
I hate to tell this, but we were at an auction and a Warhol soup can came up and it went for a lot of money. And it kept going up and up and up. And I turned to Eli and I said, what idiot would pay that much for that? And he had bought it.
She also didn't tell you that. probably in the late 60s, she saw soup cans at Ferris Gallery.
Yeah, right. Ferris Gallery had all the soup cans, and they were $100.
It's a landmark show in LA,
$100
and you saw
a piece,
it,
and I wanted to buy one, and I thought, if I bring home a painting of a Campbell soup can, I was thinking I would put it in my kitchen, it would be fun, and that Eli would think I had lost my mind. So we didn't have really a lot of money then. That would have evoked some discussion.
The acquisition budget might have gone down.
I really didn't really get involved in art till about 40 years ago, so I was a slow starter. But I learned a great deal from Meade and a number of other collectors who were very helpful to me.
Hi, my name is Sans Alexander. I also want to thank you so much, all four of you.
Welcome.
And thank you for the beautiful museum. I'm excited as well. I'm always going to MoCA and taking a look. My question is, you said something a few seconds ago, Edie. You said, when I was younger and I started collecting, I wanted to buy things that were inexpensive. I'm a pretty big art collector as well, but I'm still on that path right there where I do a lot of emerging art. Can you please recommend something that you would suggest to a collector that they can buy that's still kind of not expensive?
Well, I don't know that we all have to collect the same thing. I think young emerging artists, professors that teach art that are also artists, but also there's probably pockets and periods of art that have been neglected. I don't really know this, but I'm wondering if many people collect architectural drawings. I think it has to be something that you're interested in. But I have a feeling there's a lot of things to collect. I think a collector collects, and when they get priced out of one area, they find something else to collect.
Mm-hmm. Very true. Yeah.
Hello. Dr. Eric Kandel, the Nobel Prize winner in biology and neuroscience, recently published a book about his appreciation and love of Viennese art, pre-war Viennese art, and the interrelationship between art and the brain. I know that your philanthropy encompasses molecular biology and neuroscience very importantly. So my question is, do you have any thoughts of devoting any of the art museum to the interplay of art and the brain, number one? And number two, looking a little further ahead, any interest in considering how artificial intelligence machines might be able to produce art and how that would be regarded?
Well, in addition to being involved in the arts, we also are involved in scientific and medical research. And the biggest thing we're doing is that partners with Harvard and MIT and the Broad Institute in Genomics, and they're doing quite a bit in studying the brain, and we've also funded a program to study brain at Caltech. Now, I cannot say that we've merged the two in any meaningful way yet.
But the, Caltech gave us a print of the DNA, the design.
The double helix.
The double helix, and we have it framed. So I don't know if that counts.
I'd like to have you describe more the idea of the open storage that you were speaking about and how it's located in the museum and what I might be looking for when the museum opens.
Sure. Well, the museum is due to open in late 2014, and as I think you all know, just up the street a few blocks from here, next door to Disney Hall and across from MoCA. The idea, what happened was that we didn't actually give the architects in the competition the directive to make the storage visible, to be honest with you. But DSR came up with this idea of doing it by way of windows that are off of a stairwell, large windows that'll look out over just exactly how art is stored. I've been telling Eli I might have to slightly curate those racks to make them, you know, but make them interesting to look at. But essentially exactly how you would see storage, you know, paintings hanging on racks the way that they are, you know, racks that are just a few feet apart, and there'll be two different views into that area. But it's also partly with this building just the idea that this so-called vault, the moniker that the architects have come up with, the veil and the vault, the exterior of the building and then the vault on the inside, is just a lovely metaphor for the dual responsibilities of a museum or a collector to both preserve and display. Mm-hmm. So.
Have you thought of any plans yet what the museum might be doing 20, 25 years from now? Would it not be doing when it opens?
Oh, boy.
We probably won't be here.
Well, I'm sure those plans will evolve, but we do not have a 25-year plan. We have a plan for the next 3-4 years. But I'm sure it's going to evolve, and fortunately the museum will be well endowed, so it's going to be able to continue to collect and broaden its mission and hopefully reach the largest possible audience here and elsewhere.
I'm Maura Q, and I'm, like everyone else, very grateful that you are here, and it's just a privilege to meet and see, you know, such extraordinary people. My question is in regards to celebrity and art. And, for example, in Russia, the most expensive painting that was ever sold was painted by Vladimir Putin, which I find rather interesting. And, of course, here we have, you know, issues like with the MoCA. There were questions about, you know, I'm having a blank moment, but the, you know, the gentleman, the actor, Dennis?
Hopper. Dennis Hopper.
It was the actor that, you know, and, you know, people... Is this really an artist, or is this a celebrity you know, become an artist because they're a celebrity and therefore the work has value? What are your, anybody on the panel, what are your thoughts on the interrelationship between celebrity and art?
We spent time in Russia a number of years ago. We went to visit artist studios in Moscow and St. Petersburg, and we're impressed with some of these people who were not exactly... popular with the regime, and it was fascinating to see what they were doing. We also visited artists in Cuba at one time and elsewhere. So it's all interesting. And
we don't own anything by Putin.
Mrs. Brode, I'm curious what art you have hanging in your bedroom.
What's hanging in our bedroom? We have Cy Twombly,
Jasper Johns,
and Cy Twombly and Jasper Johns.
Sure.
Well, it's still Cy Twombly. Cy Twombly and Jasper Johns. We have several works.
Of each
in our bedroom.
Two sculptures and two paintings of Johns and one large Cy Twombly painting.
Yeah, it's lovely to wake up in the morning and look at.
Hi. I'm just curious as to what kind of membership or admission the museum will be charging or not charging, or is there going to be a fee for people to visit the museum?
We're studying that. We've given various thoughts to whether we ought to have some free days or something more extensive than that. We do not plan on having a membership nor development operation because we'll be well endowed. And we will spend quite a bit of energy and time and money, frankly, marketing, which will benefit all the art institutions downtown, especially MoCA. And we hope that our attendance will be significant and that attendance will help everyone else downtown.
One of the things we've been thinking about is if you're a member of MoCA, then you can come. That card would work at our museum.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
This is just so great that our downtown area will be enlivened in this way. My question is, can you tell us a little bit more about the visitor experience? Like, what's going to happen when they first enter the museum? What's the main lobby going to be like? How will they traffic through the museum? What stopping points will there be? And how will a visitor to the museum really experience it?
Well, let me start out by saying the museum first floor lobby is going to be very architecturally exciting. Then to get to the galleries on third floor, they're going to go on a very fascinating escalator that goes up 105 feet. That's going to be glass encased. And then there are these wonderful galleries that are ceilings are, what, 20-some-odd feet?
23 feet to the bottom of those skylights that you can see on the screen right now.
With all toplet and so on. And we're working out the there'll be sort of chronologically, and we're going to show the masterworks from our collection. And a few artists will show in greater depth. Then on the first floor, where we have another 15,000 square feet, we'll continue to show the permanent collection, but over a period of time, we expect we're going to have exhibitions here about two or three times a year. Mm-hmm. So we want to keep the place alive, have people coming back, and not saying I've been there and why come back. We also, by the way, have what I call a lecture hall on the second floor for 200 people. So we expect to have some interesting programming there.
And am I right that your exhibition program will enable borrowing from other institutions to complement the works of art in the museum?
Well, we're going to start out with some of the artists that we have in great depth. Mm-hmm. Where frankly, we don't have to borrow, but then we'll borrow and add to things.
Which could be very interesting, too.
The idea is that the shows will always connect to the collection.
Oh, of course.
In some very significant way.
Yeah.
And so the artist featured might be an artist in the collection, or the theme might be something that's particularly strong in the collection. But we will have temporary exhibitions that change about three times a year on the first floor.
And then do you want to tell them about what's going on behind the museum or next to the museum?
Well, in addition to building the museum in a three-story parking garage below, which we built for the city, we're building a plaza next to it that'll have a very interesting restaurant on it. We're widening the sidewalks on both sides of Grand Avenue to make it more pedestrian-friendly and doing quite a bit with landscape. So Grand Avenue's going to be very different once we're done.
Hi, Eli and Edie. Really, thank you for what you guys have done and your dedication. I'm really drawn to this museum being about contemporary political and social provocative art. I'm a mixed media provocative artist as well, and I've had success because I've really been a risk taker. Is there anything that you see that would be off limits as far as a theme dealing with provocative political or social art, being on the heels of 9/11 or the Holocaust, obviously, things like that? Is there anything that you would say is off limits to the museum, or is everything open?
I think it's everything's pretty well open. We have artists by someone you may have never heard of, Sue Coe, who did some interesting work that showing what's happening in slaughterhouses and what happens in the protests and British air bases and so on. So we're drawn to that type of work. But I can't think of anything that's really off limits.
Hi, thanks so much for all the wisdom. Just curious if you have any memorable moments at auction when buying art.
Any auctions?
At auctions.
Oh, my God. You heard one from my wife.
That was a big one.
Well, memorable moments are things I wish we had bought that we didn't buy. For example, about 15 years ago, we were the underbidder on a David Smith Cubi. And it took us another 10 years before we found one we finally did. So we think of all the things we might have done that we missed. And you can't do everything, although we try.
The first thing we bought at auction was of the Van Gogh drawing. And to me, that was exciting, to be bidding and to get something. And then afterwards at the auction, they have a reception for all the people that were successful bidders.
The first auction I attended was quite an amazing experience that I attended with Eli, and I was with him and very new to all of this, and we were at Sotheby's auction house, and when you arrive, you line up to get your paddle so that they know what number you are and all of that. So Eli, I knew from, because I'd been doing research on the work, that he was interested in the cover lot for that evening, and the cover lot is always the star piece for that evening. And he, Sotheby's at that time had decided to experiment a little bit with taking credit cards for purchases, believe it or not. And I remember standing right beside him and hearing him ask the person handing out the paddles, "Well, is it true what I hear that you're taking credit cards?" And dutifully, the probably intern from Sotheby's handing out paddles said, why yes. And I thought, oh, she probably had no idea she was talking to the person who's going to bid on the cover lot. And so, in fact, that was a beautiful Lichtenstein painting that's in the collection to this day. And it cost quite a bit. It was a multi-million dollar acquisition, and so it was put on the credit card. At that time, frequent flyer miles programs were more. And in a true Broad gesture, at the end of the day, they didn't use the frequent flyer miles for themselves. They gave them away to students who needed to travel. Mm-hmm. So for art students who needed to travel to, So.
They disbanded that policy.
And the next auction I went to, the auctioneer in front of about 1,000 attendees says, just to let everyone know, we no longer take credit cards. Okay. Eli.
That's true.
That was funny.
Well, on that wonderful note, I have to say that I envy all of you Angelinos for having people like Eli, well, specifically for having Eli and Edie Broad as part of your community, for all that they do for you and for this great gift that they are giving to the city on Grand Avenue. So it's been a pleasure to be part of this. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Inga.
Thank you.
Can we get up?
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.